tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Maggie Gilmore, librarian at the DC Public Library. On today's Notes from the Library, I'm joined by fellow librarian and manager of the Northwest One Library, Bobby Doherty.
Hello.
And we're going to tell you about the Read Your Way Up bike tour. DC Public Library port-a-branches and kiosks of the 1970s and 80s that took place on November 4th as part of the 2018 DC History Conference. We're also joined here by one of the participants on the bike ride, Tim Wright, who is the owner of Attucks Adams Walking Tours here in DC.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Tim.
Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Tell us about Attucks Adams. Where did you come up with that name for your business?
Attucks Adams. Yeah, thanks for asking. The name is really two people's names put into one. Crispus Attucks, who was a free black man in Massachusetts, who was the first casualty of the Boston Massacre, therefore being the first person to die in the American Revolution. And John Adams, who was the first president to occupy the White House, making the federal government whole here in Washington, D.C.
You've been to the Crispus Attucks Park?
I have, yes, many times.
It's really cute and hidden and nice. Really,
it is hidden. It's absolutely hidden.
Have you been there, Maggie?
No, I haven't.
You've probably ridden your bike around it and not realized.
Where is it?
Is it Bloomingdale or what neighborhood is that?
Oh, right. It's tucked away behind in some alleys.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Actually, right.
That was the first. I didn't know who Crispus Attucks was until I saw the park first.
Yeah. Formally, I feel like more people maybe know who he is now than, you know, when I was researching that stuff in high school, but I think the name's out there now.
Yeah, it's a great name. Oh, I guess I knew the band.
Oh, right,
also,
yeah.
Because there was a band called Crispus Attucks.
From DC, that's right.
That, and I did not know who Crispus Attucks was, but there was a hardcore band called Crispus Attucks. Yeah.
So what is Attucks Adams? What your walking tour business?
Yeah, absolutely. The tour, the walking tour company is about, I used to teach American government and civics. And after that, I worked at a museum that was about the National Building Museum, a museum about the built environment, architecture, construction, and engineering. So those are sort of the two directions I come from for the tours. A little bit of American history, a little bit of civics, and a little bit of the built environment. So we try to explore DC through those two, you know, lenses.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
And we're going to talk about the public library buildings of DC today. We hope, as we told Tim when we started the bike ride and everyone, all the other participants, we hope by the end of this segment that you, the listener, know the difference between a kiosk, a port-a-branch, and a storefront library. We sure did not know the difference, and we learned a lot about this history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, same here.
As we put this ride together, yeah.
Yes, we did learn a lot. It was a lot of fun doing the research for this ride. So for a little bit of context, Maggie and I... we've been planning bike rides as library programs for basically a decade now. We, Maggie more so now than me, love to bike everywhere. And the city's changed a lot and biking infrastructure has changed a lot over the past decade. And we liked to, about a decade ago, the library started building, renovating a bunch of new libraries. And we thought it would be a great idea to kind of hop on a bike and explore the changing libraries and the evolving communities around and seeing how the library services might be changing as well. So we started the Tour to DCPL. It traditionally occurs during Bike Month, which is in May, and visits various locations. And residents learn about library services, discover new routes and great bike paths to get to their libraries and all that kind of good stuff. So yeah, we're still kind of doing that. Things have changed a lot. And we actually started this ride at the Shaw Library, which 10 years ago was the first stop of our, the second stop. We started at MLK, I think, the first year. But the second stop of our first ever tour to DCPL when it was in an interim little trailer. So, Tim, why did you kind of choose to come on our bike ride this time?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, libraries that I interacted with are ones that were in the neighborhood that I live in, which was for 15 years Mount Pleasant. And now I live in northeastern Carver Langston, or the library near my office, which was downtown MLK. So really, I had only interacted with two libraries. So I really wanted to see all the other libraries, mm-hmm. but also to hear the history of like this great public service in the district and just the little individual histories of the different libraries. So that was my main motivation. The secondary motivation was I love seeing DC by bicycle more so than walking sometimes. And that's my sort of secondary motivation.
So I think you also attended, you were at the DC History Conference, right? You did some tabling for that this year?
Just tabling for a little bit for the tour business.
Yeah. Meeting. So we wanted to be both neither Maggie or myself had participated in the conference before, so we're like wannabe archivists. Basically, we are not archivists.
Okay. We just public service library.
We are, but we love DC history. We love those programs because not only it's interesting to us, it's always great to do a program that's interesting to you. That's but right. It's also people love coming out for that stuff, and it's a really great way to meet new, meet people that love DC history and also usually love the library too, and out and about. So we thought, you know, what's the theme for this year's history conference? Let's see if we can come up with a program. And the theme was mobility, migration, and movement. And it happened the first weekend of November, and that's why we had our ride then. And they accepted our proposal, which was awesome. So we were thinking, you know, what are locations that kind of library locations that represent the changes that are going on in the community, and how over time have those locations shifted when the city's been shifting? And so we came up with the history of the kiosks.
Yeah, we decided to focus on the kiosk libraries, knowing that the Deanwood kiosk is still standing over at Nanny Helen Burroughs Avenue, Minnesota Avenue Northeast, where now it's Marvin Gaye Park. The R.L. Christian Porta Branch at the corner of 13th and H Street Northeast was recently demolished, but it still lives in recent memory for the residents of the H Street corridor. We needed to do some further research to inform the rest of our ride, so we turned to our special collections and library archives, where we found this DC Public Library Traceries Report, published in 1997. This is a book that details library construction projects and sites past and present, and there is so much information in this volume.
Yeah. Traceries is a company. Have you ever worked with Traceries? Have you heard of them, too?
No, I have not.
So they're a DC. I don't feel like they're an architectural firm or anything like that, but they, I think people hire them to do these really in-depth like kind of surveys. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was called a survey. It was like we called it a report, but I actually think it was called a survey. And it's like my favorite book in the world, this thing that they made in 1997 that's just super detailed with, you know, write-ups of the history of every building or space, whether it's existing or not anymore, that the library had a foot in. Mm-hmm. So some of them were partnerships with other agencies, which is something that we think now is this like novel approach to service when, oh no, we've literally always tried that. We've tried it. We tried it in, you know, turn of the century. We tried it in the 40s. Like we've always been sort of coming up with interesting ways to try to kind of meet people where they are. So you mentioned a little bit about your company, Attucks Adams, and we were kind of hoping you could share a little bit about what your process is for how do you determine what kind of tour you want to do, how do you research what you're going to include, and what sort of resources you use in the city or online or wherever you go to kind of create.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you hoping that I'll say DCPL?
I mean, maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, of course, right? The library is a huge resource. As I said before, I'm a former civics instructor and student of history and civics, and people interacting with not just the government, but themselves, with each other. And I try to use that to inform the tour. So, for example, one of the most popular tours, or the most popular tour I've done this year in 2018, is about U Street, and it's about Black Broadway. And it explores the sort of form of music that happened in Black Broadway, some stories of the people that live there and perform there, and also some of the built environment, some of the venues. And so the process of, you know, researching individual venues and buildings, some of them don't exist anymore. Obviously, the library is a huge resource for that. Some of the stuff you can get on the internet, but not everything. And then also the people. Some of them are obvious, like Duke Ellington. People usually associate with U Street or with jazz music, also in New York. But you have other artists that played, and you want to tell their stories, and you have to research to find those stories because not all of them are in popular culture or in the public domain. Also talking to people that own some of the buildings or have performed in some of the buildings. And then doing a lot of image researches. Images are a really big part of my tour, showing images of what used to be versus what is there now.
Do you use like a technology? Like how do you include? You might want to know, listener, that I had to lug around a giant binder with printouts of things as opposed to maybe utilizing some 21st century technology on our ride.
Now, thanks to Capital Bike Share because they're
It was a jump bike.
Sorry.
The bucket.
Thanks to Jump Bike because of their large front basket that fit the binder through the whole ride.
We don't have to thank them. I paid for that ride.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, though, modern conveniences make telling stories a lot easier. So, you know, for example, I'll just use the U Street Tour again. I don't have a binder, but I do have a little tablet computer. You know, it's basically a screen you can hold. And so that's what I show some of the old photos there. And I also have a little Bluetooth speaker. We listen to that. There's a soundtrack for the tour. And so I'll play music from the era on the little Bluetooth speaker. So, you know, it's simple stuff. It's nothing really complicated. But people's different senses are engaged through the technology. And also we're walking around, you know, motion creates emotion and feeling, and you know, it's a walking tour, so that sort of the visceral senses plus the technology helps, you know, hopefully create like a real story that people can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah.
And who's your audience for these? Who is attending? Are they tourists? Are they residents?
Locals? Yeah, a mix. You know, mostly tourists from, not from the Washington, D.C. area, but I don't know. I would say maybe this year it's been maybe 15 or 20% from D.C. and the surrounding, you know, Virginia and Maryland.
We get a lot of people coming to D.C. local history. Or not, I don't know really what percentage, but a lot of people that are newer to the area crave learning about the history, right? Because it's hard sometimes when so much development is, they walk around and say, I don't really know what was here because everything seems...
That's it. I mean, I would say of the local folks, most of that subset of people are new to Washington, D.C., and they're interested in D.C. as a seat of national government, but they're way more interested in, like, the other parts of D.C., like the local parts, where they live.
Like micro... We were talking about micro geographies as we consider our new strategic plan for DC Public Library is titled Know Your Neighborhood. Mm. And we're looking at particular initiatives to hone in the different neighborhoods based on, you know, what we can do through the library and how we can support community communicating with each other and learning their own history. Mm.
Cool. Thanks for sharing all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so sort of relates to what you were just saying, Maggie.
Yeah.
But so DC Public Library has always needed to be flexible and responsive to communities in which we're embedded in that we serve. And as the changes are occurring, whether or not it's in the city or even within our own budget or staffing or capabilities, staff and administrators have to evaluate, you know, effectiveness of service. And we do this all the time. We do it either through formal planning or maybe just, you know, every year's budget or whatever it is. And it was really interesting reading through this report from 1997 because it really sort of just emphasized what we already knew, that we were doing this before 1997, we were doing it in 1997, and we're doing it at this exact moment at the library. So we're going to talk for a bit on what we focused on the ride, which was really the 60s and what was supposed to just be the 60s and 70s, but really went all the way to the 90s and into 2008 when... I guess I'll mention it now, when the last kiosks were shuttered, 2008 to 2009, which is just extremely wild when you are physically on this ride and you see the structures and you see what people had to accept as normal library, a library, which is just a tiny shack. So we're going to talk about the 60s. Maggie's going to share a little bit about the development, what was going on, particularly as we started the ride, which was at the Shaw Library into the Northwest One community.
Yeah, this was in the 1960s, a moment when DC was allowing the construction of Highway 95 to cut this massive swath through the city, causing, you know, huge amount of displacement. The Northwest One neighborhood and Shaw neighborhood vehemently opposed and resisted this highway project, and successfully, which is why you come off of 95 into the middle of DC onto New York Avenue, and then you aren't really anywhere. No, traffic snarl. So at the same time as all of this was going on, the Johnson administration was developing this anti-poverty and federal urban aid program called Model Cities. Although funding was approved by Congress in 1966, D.C. didn't see the projects come to fruition until 1971. And then the whole project was terminated. The funding was taken away in 1974.
It was always considered an experimental project. I feel like that language is always present when you're reading about it.
Mm-hmm. So for D.C., Model Cities was a nationwide program for urban development. And in Washington, D.C., the area that was decided upon for these particular projects was a 675-acre area around Shaw, Trinidad, and the Stanton Park 8th Street Northeast corridor. D.C. got $3.2 million, and Watha T. Daniel, actually, who the Shaw Library is named after, he was on the board for the Model Cities project. So he was one person who oversaw all of these various projects, including a retirement center, a boys' club, daycare, the German measles inoculation.
Extremely important.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. As well as expanded library bookmobile service and the establishment of these four storefront libraries that were identified in these particular neighborhoods. So the Harrison Storefront Community Library opened at 1419 V Street Northwest, the Trinidad Storefront Library at 1603 Montello Avenue Northeast, and the Sibley Plaza Storefront Library at 1140 North Capitol Street, all opened in 1971. The Stanton Park Community Storefront Library at 1003 H Street Northeast opened in 1972. It is now a CrossFit gym. And that particular location was soon named after the community leader who had recently passed away, R.L. Christian. Each of these storefront libraries had between 2,500 to 5,000 books and stations for viewing films, records, and tapes, as audiovisual access was a really important component to the Model Cities program for libraries at that point.
It's hard to know. You might think 2,500 to 5,000 books is a lot. It is not a lot. Cleveland Park open up with 40,000 books or something?
Wow.
Like, I just made that number up. But yeah, That's a very small number of books.
I have no concept of how many books are in.
I mean, you might have that many books at home, too. No, it's
no,
a lot
I
of books.
Don't have
a lot
many
of
books.
No, it's a lot of books. But it's really quite small amount. Okay. Even now when, you know, people say, well, nobody reads books. Print books anymore. No, we still buy a lot of books when we open new libraries, far more than 5,000.
Yep.
And we're probably not going to mention it again, but the Harrison Storefront Community Library was one of the ones that was hardly there. I feel like just a handful of years. I wish that we could have learned more about it, because it was hard for me to imagine what it was, because I think the building that it was in was demolished. I think it's just a parking lot now. It was attached to the Ecumenical Center of St. Augustine's Church, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting to me, because I feel like it was a public government and Catholic Church partnership or something, which is just something we haven't seen
recently.
So, yeah. So, and I don't think it was very long, but that seemed very interesting to me, but it did close because, of lots of reasons. It wasn't that far from Shaw either, but yeah, that was right around New Street, 1419 V Street.
Mm.
Pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. And the Model Cities funding wrapped up in 1974. So DC Public Library did decide to close that Harrison Community Library. But some of the others were able to maintain funding for a bit longer through DC government funding. At the same time, of course, DC is just getting into home rule in 1974. Mm-hmm. That is what it took effect at that point. Mm-hmm. So we were negotiating being autonomous for the first time.
And funding our own library system.
Mm-hmm.
So right around this time also is when the new Central Library, which was named Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library, opened up. The old Central Library was in Mount Vernon Square. It's soon to be an Apple store if that hasn't opened yet, and the DC Historical Society and Events DC. It's a pretty cool space. It was a Carnegie Library. It's really beautiful. It's probably going to be pretty interesting to see when they finish the renovations. But MLK opened with lots of fanfare. Mies van der Rohe designed building, his only library, his only building in Washington. He passed away before it was finished. So it opened up in 72. And at the same time, there was a moratorium placed by the, you know, they weren't called, I can't remember what they were called, but, you know, the city government, as it was at that time, on construction of traditional library branches. So they said, we're not going to give anybody lots of money to build a whole new neighborhood library. We want to spend some time evaluating community needs, exploring more flexible, cost-efficient options for providing library service. And as a result of that, basically them saying, we don't have any money and we don't have the time to plan effectively for big neighborhood libraries, they said, well, let's build some kiosks. And what are the kiosks? I mean, when you think of the word kiosk, what do you think of? I think of a place to get my ears pierced at the mall.
Right, yeah.
Like to get travel information.
And very small.
Yeah, very small. Yeah. Like a photo booth size kind of thing. So the kiosk library structure was sort of developed as this supposed to be temporary space for library service that was only 120 square feet. Very small amount of public land was used, so they were able to find really small parcels of land. Only about 1,000 volumes were of books were included in the kiosks on standing book racks. They were made of aluminum. They were prefabricated with windows of unbreakable materials, in quotes, and a, quote, fresh imaginative look.
That's from the Traceries.
Yeah, from the Traceries report.
They weren't wrong.
Yeah, yeah. There is still one standing. We'll talk about that. It is pretty fresh. They were implemented as a testing site to gauge the volume of library transactions within a particular community. The idea would be, you know, we could, you know, determine, do we need a bigger library here? Okay, well, we'll get a bigger library. Let's move the kiosk to the next test site and see if they need a library or not. They built kiosks initially for Berry Farms, Parklands, which is along Alabama Avenue in Southeast, and Deanwood, which is in Deanwood. Berry Farms is in Berry Farms. If you don't know where they are, okay, look it up. those were the three, and they opened in 76. And the one that's standing, I think that was the, what is it? What's it called? 200 years. Everybody was like, the USA is 200. What was that called in 1976?
Oh, the Bicentennial?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's why I think the colors on the Deanwood kiosk are red, white, and blue.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because everything was red, white, and blue that year. You see stuff.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah. So 1976. The Deanwood kiosk, one I was just talking about, is still standing. It's on Nanny Helen Burroughs Road.
Avenue?
North Avenue? Northeast. Avenue? Road?
I think
Boulevard?
Road. I think Road.
Road. Nanny Helen Burroughs. Look it up. You'll find it. There's only one in Northeast. And you can still visit it. It's got some bike share racks around it. It's got a Lady Bird Johnson Park / Marvin Gaye Park. Or it's Lady Bird Johnson like Field or something in the park. Flower Butterfly Garden or something. It's a cool little site that's connected to some really nice bike paths. There's a Wendy's across the street. And something else. I don't remember what else is around there. But it's nice to visit. You can still see it while it's still standing. DC Public Library, we should note, does not own that building anymore. So it's not there because we aren't dealing with it. We as in the library.
It's a fascinating little structure. It's so small, and I think the fact that it was empty made it even more fascinating to me.
Yeah. It had an incinerating toilet.
Yeah.
It apparently never worked. It exploded.
I mean, was it 120 square feet?
Yeah.
That's
so small.
That's very small.
Yeah. Very, very, very small. Okay. So Berry Farms was a kiosk was erected at 1430 Sumner Road, and it was only there until 1984 because another kind of experimental partner library situation opened, which was a public library within a school called Garnet C. Wilkinson. And then that partnership did not exist for very, I feel like only a handful of years, because then the library lost funding and pulled out and just let the school take over the space. But it was quite a big library from the square footage that the Traceries report shared at Garnet Wilkinson. The Parklands kiosk, though, is another story. They operated at Alabama and Stanton Road, and then in 84 moved just across the way to a Porta branch, which is the next vocabulary keyword to remember from this segment. at 1720, and it's now then in 2009 moved to, because I don't know if we're going to talk about Parklands again.
That's true.
Yeah, they moved to where they are now, which is in a strip mall.
A storefront library.
A storefront library, yet again, but they don't call it that. They just call it Parklands Sterner Neighborhood Library. Right at the shopping center with the Giant, right? Not the Safeway, the Giant, the IHOP on Alabama Avenue.
On Alabama Avenue.
I can't remember. Yeah, so they're still there until further notice, but I think that they will get a larger library sometime in the next couple of years.
Right. And that's a community that has continually given feedback that they desire a larger library space, and the numbers are there to prove that they certainly do.
Yeah. But what's a Porter Branch, Maggie?
So Porter Branch, which is what the Parklands Turner Community Library moved into from their kiosk in 1984, that was basically a larger version of a kiosk. It was like DC Public Library looked at this model, said, okay, this does kind of work, but they need to be bigger. They were designed by Porta Structures Industries Incorporated, and it was, again, temporary, relocatable was the idea. Mm-hmm. It was at about 1,600 square feet and could accommodate 5,000 volumes, and allowed 25 to 30 patrons inside at one time. So this is another issue with the kiosks at Porta Branches. There's a capacity that was continually met, and people would have to wait outside until someone left. So the Porta Branches came into effect over almost a decade or more, in addition to the Parklands Turner Porta Branch. In 1981, the R.L. Christian Community Library Porta Branch replaced that Model City storefront library, and that was at 1301 H Street Northeast. In 1983, the Langston Community Library opened, Tim, in your neighborhood.
That's right.
At 650 26th Street Northeast. And in 1993, the Sursum Corda Community Library opened at 135 New York Avenue Northwest.
And that one is amazing to me, that in 1993, this is still where they were with what a new library might be for a neighborhood that needs it. It had been 10 years since they'd even built the last one.
You mean as a Porta Branch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just trying to imagine. I saw the old R.L. Christian Porta Branch, you know, it wasn't a library when I first encountered it, but I actually can't even imagine 30 patrons mm-hmm. being inside and doing anything besides trying to fit inside, like not reading or doing anything productive. It just... You know.
And these were really popular sites. They were heavily used. And the communities, when they did close, you know, some even a decade later in 2008, were upset and wanted to retain their Porta Branch. They got this connection to it. It was cute and adorable, and the staff was wonderful.
It's always very intimate when you use it. I mean, there's only going to be one or two people staffing it. So if you go there regularly, you know, like any library, really, if you go there regularly, you get to know the people that are there. But there was definitely that feeling of loss.
Yeah. And there was this pride in having them as part of your community. But the problem is that the library service had expanded so drastically. Mm. And, you know, with technology, access to technology, and just what a space can be through the 90s and 2000s. So it was important that the community see the possibilities beyond.
And, and not think that that's all they deserved and that's what a library was. Mm-hmm. When that's not true. And it wasn't true for residents all over the city.
Yeah. So getting back to the ride, we started at the Shaw Library on a bright, beautiful, crisp, sunny mm-hmm. morning. We got very lucky with weather. And we rode on Q Street over to First, past that previous Sursum Corda site. Bob, you want to tell us a little bit about Northwest One now?
Yeah, so I'm currently the manager of Northwest One Neighborhood Library, and I worked there previously from about 2009 to 2012, just as a librarian or library associate. And that was when we opened that branch. So Northwest One is what it's called now. And before it was Northwest One, it was the previously mentioned Sursum Corda Porta Branch Community Library. And before that, from 1972 or three, when it was the Sibley Plaza storefront library and Sursum Corda storefront library. So initially with Model Cities, they opened up this experimental space. Sibley Plaza is an apartment building. It's still on North Capitol Street, Northwest. And it's one of the two really, really large ones when you're around on North Capitol between L and M on the west side when you're going south on North Capitol. And it's a big building. And they opened up a library space on a floor in that building that they were going to gear towards seniors. And then they opened up a second storefront library within Sursum Corda, which was a big housing kind of project that opened in 68, I think, and just was demolished this week. So it's gone.
Right. When we rode by in November, it was still on standing. November 4th,
It wasn't even...
It was closed. Gated? The gate was around it. It was closed. The residence had been vacated. And this last week, I rode my bike past, and it's completely gone. And it's demolished.
Wow.
Okay.
And yeah, it's just a really pile of rubble. It's really so. The current Northwest One Library is a block from there, and so it's been really insane to see it. There was this plant I was trying to save that had been growing near one. It was a eastern prickly pear, which is the only cactus that I'm aware of that's native to this area. And I was like, somebody was growing a prickly pear. I want to get it, but it's really hard to get it. You can't just grab a cactus. I accidentally tried that once with another prickly pear. It was a really dumb move. So I knew,
Now, Bobby, you actually work with a couple of staff members who used to work at the Sursum Corda Porta Branch.
Absolutely,
What have they told you about it?
So it's a really tight-knit group of staff, and some of them have worked. They worked not only from 1993 on at the Porta Ranch, but one of them even worked when it was in the neighborhood. So as I was saying, there was the Sibley Plaza storefront during the Model Cities era and the Sursum Corda storefront. And the Sursum Corda storefront was the one inside the neighborhood, and that was supposed to be for children. And the Sibley Plaza one was for adults. And they sort of realized early on that that wasn't working because adults were coming to the children's one saying, making up excuses for getting books when it was really that their reading level and the books of their, they weren't getting what they needed at the Sibley Plaza one. So they actually consolidated and they made it just inside Sursum Corda. And actually the impetus that I think we read in a couple articles or in the report for opening up the Sursum Corda Porta Branch, which was outside of the actual neighborhood and across New York Avenue, was because of the degree of crime that was happening within the community, and the staff and the community nobody was particularly safe, unfortunately, accessing that library at that time in the 90s.
And the library wanted more visibility.
Yeah, they were really stuck. Sursum Corda was built as a kind of what's that thing called where you get just stuck in it, like a maze, a labyrinth sort of sorts.
Like very insular.
Really, if you didn't live in that neighborhood, you weren't going to go in there to use the library. It didn't make any sense.
Right.
Which a little bit was what Langston was like as well. So they moved it out, and a couple staff still work at Northwest One that worked at Sursum. Northwest One is called Northwest One because in the 60s when they were redeveloping that area, they named that neighborhood that, and it was actually it's the number one voting precinct. So when you go to vote, that's your place to vote, which is Walker Jones Education Campus. It's voting precinct number one. I voted in 56 or something.
That was the number one mystery that I wanted solved on the tour. Why is it called Northwest One?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's still unclear who named it that. It seems like it was whoever was developing the government or the developers in the 60s at the time. Because nobody knows why it's called what it means.
It's not obvious.
I'm going to move us along a little bit and take the listener through this bike ride. After Northwest One and the Sursum Corda corridor, we traveled through NOMA past our own container lab, which is a fabrication lab in a shipping container. It's very interesting. You can learn much more about that with several other of our podcasts. And then into the Trinidad neighborhood, we stopped by the Montello Avenue storefront, and that is now a barbershop.
Montello Barbershop, I think.
Yeah, Montello Barbershop. It's an interesting story with this particular storefront because it was closed in 1983, and the collection was moved to that new Arl Christian Porta Branch. So the Mount Olivet Heights Citizens Association actually decided to open their own library within the Wheatley Rec Center. They established a collection based on donations from people across the city. Even the Cleveland Park Library Friends donated books to this particular library. So that operated for a long time. There's a great Washington Post article that talks about the importance that the community felt of giving young people access to literature and just simply reading and how important that was. There's a sign poster, a poster above this height gauge in the rec center that says, read your way up the scale. Mm. That's a little bit from where, how we titled the ride. The residents of Trinidad actually remain without a library in close proximity, and they continue to use that rec center for computer use and access to the internet, even today. Their closest library is the Rosedale Neighborhood Library, which we actually passed as we went along. We continued to the R.L. Christian site. It was that Porter Branch was demolished there at 13th and H, and now there's a brand new apartment building standing.
If you look online, it says R.L. Christian Apartments, but I have this feeling that they will not end up calling it that. I think
they may retain that dedication to longtime resident of the neighborhood.
I hope so.
Yeah. I think people might need to make some noise about that, but yeah.
So then we kept going on Gales Avenue past the Rosedale Library, which is co-located with a recreation center. And we stopped along the bike path at Benning Road and Oklahoma Avenue Northeast to talk about the Langston Community Library. The Porter Branch site is now where that Department of Transportation's trolley headquarters is.
The trolley. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Tim can talk about the trolley.
The streetcar.
Yeah, the streetcar. Oh, yeah, streetcar. Trolley.
Tim, in light of the short amount of time we have, tell us which Langston was the Langston Carver Terrace named after?
Oh, right. So, the neighborhood is Carver Langston, named after George Washington Carver and John Mercer Langston, who was the first African-American representative in the United States Congress from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Mm-hmm. Not to be confused with Langston Hughes, who's probably the more famous
Langston. But who in the 40s was still... So he wasn't having apartment buildings named after him.
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you mentioned Rosedale, just now my neighborhood library, even though it's not in my neighborhood, it's the next neighborhood over. One of my favorite facilities because it's a combo facility because it has, you can come to play ball, you can come to swim, you can come to use a library, or you can come to check a book out.
That's great.
Yeah. Right. It's a great way to align city services and talk about civic engagement and kind of one-stop shop.
Yeah. Langston is interesting. It was actually, it predates the storefront communities because the original Langston Library was what was called a sub-branch. And I believe that was because it was in a basement. So also, because I don't think it means it was less than a library branch because it was pretty big, I guess, but it was the basement of a building. It opened in 43 and it didn't move until 83 into that Porter Branch. One thing of note with the opening of Langston, it was the first library, DC Public Library, to open with an African-American head librarian or manager, and her name was Althea Brown, and that was in 1943. A little tidbit of info. We went along after we left that part of Northeast across along the river, along the Anacostia bike trail, over to Nanny Hill and Burroughs Avenue. That section of the trail is really awesome. We saw lots of deer. We saw birds.
Yes, we did see deer.
We traveled through the wetlands. It was, it's just a really incredible stretch of path there. You can continue all the way to the Kenilworth Gardens and go see those along that way as well, and go all the way back to Hyattsville if you continue that way. We finished our tour over at the Deanwood Kiosk, where there's a big blue and red sign that says, read your way up, along the side of the building. When we got to Deanwood, you've talked a little bit, Tim, already. You knew it was, you'd want to see it before, or had you seen it before?
I had never seen a photo, or I'd never seen it in person.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. Was it what you expected?
I didn't have any expectations. I didn't know the difference between a Porter Branch and a kiosk.
Yes.
I just use kiosks for everything. And so to me, kiosk meant small, which the Porter Branch was, but then the actual kiosk
is even smaller.
It's even smaller.
I think that you're not the only one. I'm pretty sure people just said kiosks even within our own.
Yeah, I think they did.
Our own organization.
It just makes sense, right?
Yeah. Porter Branch is like a company.
Right.
Built them. Yeah. So we hope that people on the ride learned. We know that they did. They learned a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that people listening today, we hope you've learned something about sort of the history of the library's decision making around where they put creative temporary library services. This is a little bit connected to something that's going on now, which is the facilities master plan. So if you want to learn more about that plan and what's going on with that, you can go to dclibrary.org DC Library Future. They have focus groups and surveys, and that will be an ongoing process.
And for more about bikes and libraries, visit dclibrary.org/bike, where you can find recommended reading lists and bike-related programming. Next week, you can join us with the Book Bike. We'll be with the Washington Area Bicycle Association's Trail Ranger Coffee Hour on the Metropolitan Bike Trail right there at S Street Northeast. So that's Friday, not next, well, wait, yes, next week, Friday, December 14th. From 7:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. Yes, that's me. I will be getting up very early.
People love to bike really early.
Yeah, we'll be out there accepting book returns, checking out books, and providing free Wi-Fi or last-minute charging station on your commute to work. Coffee's provided by Quellia Coffee. And thank you, Tim Wright, for joining us today.
Where can people find more about your Addicts Adams?
Yeah, thanks for having me also. And yeah, they can find me at AddictsAdams.com, AttucksAdams, on the internet. So thank you guys again for your time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of DC Public Library's Notes from the Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. For more information about DC Public Library, visit dclibrary.org. Or follow us on social media at DC Public Library. Download this show wherever you get your podcasts by searching for Full Service Radio, DCPL Radio. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.